Welcome to the latest episode of the Design Trees podcast. My name is Brad Harper, and me and my design mate Drew catch up and chat with the different lived experiences and perspectives within the world of industrial design. Today, we're joined by Alex Peat, formerly of Dyson and Mouse, to talk about starting your own product company. So if you do half enjoy the podcast, feel free to leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and maybe even share it with a design friend of yours. Thanks as always, and let's jump straight into the podcast. We were just kind of asking Drew whether he enjoyed his birthday present, and he did. So thankfully you didn't say it was crap.
Oh man, that'd have been that, so awkward.
That would have been the most embarrassing stuff.
I've had a tough week and now this.
No, it was beautiful. Honestly, I really love it. We've talked about this before. I think we mentioned it with Hector as well. Like, I really love beautifully designed, really well thought out, well finished, tactile pieces that might be a really mundane thing in your normal life, like a bin or something like that. But when you get a really, really nice bin, it's so exciting.
You were talking about a bin in another episode, wasn't it, with Sam Does Design?
Yeah, well, it's probably the one that comes up all the time because I'm gently trying to nudge Brabantia into giving me a call.
Oh yeah, I'll try and get Gareth at Joseph on, and he can tell you about a bin for about an hour and a half. But honestly, it's just a bin. But I mean,
it was the subject of one of those Seymour Powell episodes years ago. They just redesigned a bin, and like watching them, you know, walk around it, open it up, see how you're using it, and sort of model all of that. It was fascinating, and I think, like I've said before, that was a series that made me go, oh wow, that exists as a thing to do. You don't have to just go and work shifts like whichever factory is hiring when you leave school.
I went to CES one year, you know, the electronic show in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. There was a bin that had a little slot on the bottom for when you're doing your dustpan and brush, you put the most of it in the bin, but the rest of you don't. You just sweep right into that slot and it kind of has a vacuum cleaner and sucks it off. It was drawing a crowd, man. There were people around me going crazy.
Yeah, I can imagine, yeah.
Wow. I never thought I'd hear the sentence. The bin was drawing a crowd.
Yes, it's crazy.
Christ. But yeah, the bottle opener that that arrived, designed by you, Alex, and bought by Brad. Thank you very much, Brad. It's very kind. It's very sweet.
Yeah, thank you, Brad, supporting this small business.
Of course. You've got to. Mm. That said, I just bought something from Amazon the other day. So, you know, it's... it depends what I need at the time, really. Especially the best thing to do would be just to perhaps introduce yourself. Obviously you are the creator of Drew's birthday present, but that's just one part of
the career highlight so far.
That's the highlight
exactly.
What brought you to this position?
So before I start, I just want to say congrats, guys, on the podcast. Really amazing work. But I know also you've done you've made Design Truth into a limited company, right?
We've got a VAT number, Alex. Yeah, we have a VAT number.
So that is amazing.
10 days we've had this VAT number, and it's exciting.
Explosive growth from that moment on. But also the fact that you're giving 5% back to design education, I think, is amazing.
Yeah, that's the plan.
Yeah, well done.
That's the plan at the end. I don't know how we'll go about it, but... ideally secondary schools. So I think maybe controversial, I think universities have probably a bit too much money. So if we can go into the secondary schools, maybe they've got a bit of kit they need working on or some materials, something like that.
Yeah.
I think that's the plan. If anyone has any contacts or anything like that, where they could be a little bit more specifically,
well, that's it. I mean, you know, it'd be great to have it sort of drawn from the community, for them to say where they need the support. And even if our contribution is relatively small, you know, we might probably be able to get support from universities and industry, you know, and just be the sort of lightning rod for it. But I think definitely the place to do it is that sort of late secondary school, where people think about what they're actually good at and what they enjoy.
Well, that's exactly what happened to me. So let me start the story. Let's start on a low and go up. That's always exciting, right? So I started my first job in Oxford, and I was an applications engineer. So basically it meant making little jigs and fixtures and I hated it. Like, I couldn't stand it. I'd just been snowboarding for a year in Whistler, and I had this sharp contrast. It was like, life can be amazing and fun and really energetic, and then suddenly life is me in an industrial estate in Oxford, and I hated it. So I think it was obvious that I didn't like it, so it didn't really work out. I then got a job, luckily, at Dyson, and walking around Dyson as a young sort of 23-year-old, I was just blown away by how much responsibility these people were given. People sat around a table talking about decisions that are going to affect million-dollar projects, which is just amazing. So for me, I was like, okay, this is the place to be. I'm going to learn as much as possible about physical product design. And during that time, slightly weirdly, I started a street food business.
As you do.
In Bristol, yeah. So selling pulled pork, I mean, lamb wraps, they were phenomenal. We got our name in a paper, the Sandwichiers is what we were known. But basically, I was just obsessed with learning about business and how the hell am I going to get something started for myself. And then I left Dyson to start a job at a place called CRL. And CRL is the first physical product design-based accelerator. A bit of a mouthful. But basically, if you've got an idea for an invention, you come to CRL, Central Research Laboratory in West London, and we kind of help you. So we give you through like a course. You need to do this to your design, whatever else. Link them up to manufacturers in China, whatever. But it was bonkers. And I spent I spent time with 40 businesses in 2.5 years, all with their own kind of weird and wonderful products. So loads of exposure and how to do it properly and how to not. I was about to quit in CRL to start my own business because that's kind of been the ambition the whole time. And the CEO of Mouse, you know, Mouse phone cases.
Not a day goes by when some
don't get an ad.
I'm going to have to pick your brain about this, but there's not a day that goes by where I don't see a video of someone up a crane throwing a phone off a lorry or shooting it with pellet guns or something bizarre. And I just think, I need to get this out of the way. What is the weirdest thing that ever happened in testing for a mouse product? Because it's just crazy. What I keep seeing on a daily basis.
So one of the weirdest is just someone getting really annoyed at an iPad and doing really kind of regimented drop testing where we're trying to figure out how I can say this because it's out now, but how protective the case is in. They were just like, it's not breaking, and lobbed it at a wall, like full pelt. I was like, that's not testing. That's not engineering, right? But, so I joined Mouse. I was there for 2 years. When I joined, there was about 3 or 4 engineers, and helped them grow from, 3 or 4 engineers through to like 15, went from 70 SKUs to over 300 in a very small period of time. So at the end of that, I thought, I've got too much money, life's too easy, let's quit and start from scratch. It wasn't really a shock to everyone because as I joined, I've always said, like, this is my ambition. I just started Parallel Products Limited, just launched 10 new products on the Etsy page. And it's good timing because if you talked to me a week ago, I'd have been in a slump because sales were not doing as well as I'd hoped. The last week has been insane. I've been
Father's Day
Father's Day. Everyone left it much later than I realized, but, you know, which is I probably should have guessed. But I've been up until, 11 o'clock fulfilling as many orders as I possibly can. It's been phenomenal. So
Good stuff.
Well, I can vouch.
There you go. There's your little testimonial.
Honestly, just thought it was beautiful. I think, I think sometimes just the power of a really good CMF. Just that little tactile first interaction with it, beautiful.
I'm glad you said that. I messaged Ben. Do you know Maker's Cabinet?
Maker's Department, but I don't know Maker's Cabinet.
So Maker's Cabinet, they make amazing like stationery, the hovel made from brass. So Ben is one of the people that came through CRL, which is that accelerator program I talked about. And I just WhatsApped him. I said, polished brass or sandblasted? And he just said both. And I was like, okay, thanks. Great. That's really, really helpful. But I went with sandblasted for the bottle opener and then polished for the custom Swiss Army knives. Shall I share my screen and kind of show?
Yeah, you can do. Yeah, you can share it. The people of Apple and Spotify will be wondering what the heck's going on, but the people of YouTube will love it.
So, so can you see my screen now?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the shop page, and this is the custom Swiss Army knife. So they're the polished brass. And the idea is that people can customize them with, you know, name and initials or whatever else. But this is like an original Victorinox Swiss Army knife. But then I designed the scales to snap on either side and then laser engrave them. All of it's happening from the one bed flat that I have in Brixton. So why am I Salina? It's just waiting. Basically, I have to say at 6:30, the place will be normal again, I promise. And then, you know, she just lets me go on with it.
Oh, as long as no one stands on a Swiss Army knife in the middle of the night, then that's the thing. But what was the idea behind the limited numbers there, the limited kind of stock? Is that for that bit more of a personal kind of feel? Because maybe everyone else will now want a Drew Kendrick bottle opener. So,
well, so the idea is I didn't want it to grow quickly, uncontrollably. So small batch production, all of the products that I use are CNC, which means that you deal with a higher unit cost, but you can order in lower quantities. So a lot of these are, you know, 100 unit orders. And it just means that I can kind of test the market and test the waters and which products do well and which don't. And then I can kind of react and change and go, oh, well, it seems like, and it does seem like Swiss Army knives are really good. So I'll double down and invest into that. So at the start of at the beginning of starting a business, you don't really want to put all your eggs into one basket because you've no idea what's going to happen with the market, and not just marketing itself, but actually what do people like, what products resonate with people for gifts and whatever else. So I call it the scattergun approach. So that's why I launched 10 products and let's just see which one works. When you're doing with online e-commerce, you don't know what gets clicks, what gets conversion, whatever. So I've done that. Now I'm going to learn, and then the next batch will again be smaller, but the second version might be a few more hundred units or something like that. But it's really about quality and minimizing risk. And yeah.
So how much of the production are you doing yourself? Do you have a CNC or a laser engraver or something like that in your place?
So all the assembly is done by me in Brixton. I am the bottleneck. But a lot of the CNC work is done out in China, in Dongguan. So part of Central Research Laboratory, my job was to go out and try and set up the supply chain network, as we called it. It basically consisted of WhatsApping a load of people, WeChatting a load of people saying, hey, we're coming. Can you set us up with factory tours, whatever else? So I've been to China like 15 times in, well, obviously I haven't been for ages now and I'm missing it, but I met some incredible factories that do really high quality CNC stuff. And when you're there, it's like, you know, for me personally, it's like a kid in a sweet shop. I'm just thinking, like, what can I do? What can I use particularly is going to be well suited to CNC or drop forging or whatever factories we end up going to. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's kind of the idea. And then when they come into Brixton, I'll, you know, polish them myself, engrave them myself, and then box them up.
Amazing.
Is that the plan long term?
Forever. It will always be me. No. So I've actually got an apprentice. I'm doing the Kickstart scheme, which is pretty amazing. Okay. Have you heard about this?
It's just a 16 to 24-year-old.
Yeah.
Do you get a little bit of money or kickback if you employ someone?
Exactly. Yeah. So we're getting an apprentice and we're going to teach them up, and the government will pay a bit of their salary. Mm-hmm. So the idea is, I was talking about this the other day on the podcast. It's a bit like McDonald's, not that it's going to be growing to the size of McDonald's, but it's like I'm concentrating on getting the burger correct and perfect. And then if you've seen the founder of the movie, they invent the speedy system so that they can then recreate and replicate that over and over again consistently. So right now it's like, let's get the product as good as we can possibly get it, and then in the next year or so it'll be, well, now let's figure out the processes to replicate this quality over and over again and grow from there.
Very interesting. It's like hearing someone, like, it's like hearing back after like someone's been doing the things I've dreamed about for 10 years. Okay, yeah, it was brilliant. It went exactly like you hoped.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I'm so envious. That sounds amazing. Yeah. Well, it sounds like such an adventure.
It hasn't been great. Like a week ago, you know, I was saying to Selena, I was like, starting a business is so hard. Like, I love surfing. I've surfed 7 years. I'm only just good. I say good, I'm like, okay. I thought surfing was hard. Business is on another level. You can try so hard and you get to a thing where you think this is an amazing product. And people just are so busy. They don't necessarily need to care. You're not, just because you've tried hard, they don't need to.
Yeah,
you know, they've got a day to get on with. They don't need to buy from you.
What are your?
Yeah, I mean, I think even in just sort of even in R&D, you know, you can have a fantastic product or a fantastic concept, but if it's not the thing that the company had in mind or the client had in mind, so what? You know, go and give us a surfing analogy for that then about you know.
Right. Well, I have one. I have one pre-made. So on the podcast that I do. Do you mind if I plug it?
It's go ahead.
Lockdown Livelihood. It's called Lockdown Livelihood. And my co-host, Luke, we started this challenge, which is called the Etsy Challenge. And can you create a profit on Etsy within 2 weeks? Which sounds impossible.
Is it possible?
Yeah. So I sold novelty Simpsons mugs. And made a slight profit doing print on demand. Luke sold crappy T-shirts. There you go, Lockdown Livelihood.
Nice.
Luke sold rubbish T-shirts and then changed 4 days towards the end of the challenge and decided to create Renaissance-style dog portraits. And
I've seen that too.
So his company was called Van Woof, and he went from selling a couple to selling an insane amount. And over the course of 6-7 months, he grew the company to 50 artists, sold the business for $120,000 and made $200,000 in profit in that shorter period of time, which makes you realize like Etsy is incredibly powerful. But back to the surfing analogy, the point is, business is like trying to read ripples and read the waves of what's popular at the moment. But if Luke hadn't had multiple businesses before, he may have stood up and sold a couple, but only because he's used to it and he's built businesses before was he able to build the processes, get used to this thing, and then actually make a business that capitalizes on that wave and of energy and excitement. So it's a bit like, business is a bit like reading waves, essentially, and you just need to get good. And the more you practice, the more you can kind of capitalize when you catch one.
This episode is brought to you by our sponsors, INEO Solutions. INEO are a business transformation provider and a platinum reseller of PTC and Keyshot. If you hit the link, ineo.co.uk/designtruth, it does help the podcast out quite a bit. So please do hit the link.
Yeah, I won't keep you any much longer, but do go and have a look. Go and check out their training because it will make the difference between your portfolio and the one before it and the one after it that your next hiring manager is looking at.
Good stuff. Now back to the podcast. In terms of Etsy, then, was that the plan at the start when you started Parallel? Or because it's a little bit like, I don't want to say it's a bit like Fiverr, but it's a bit like your artsy kind of not on the high street, is it not? That's kind of the platform.
So I absolutely love Etsy. Okay. The brand of Etsy, when I tell people, it's like, so you're knitting these products, right? Like it's got a real bad connotations with your sort of very crafty and not product oriented, which for me just means that's an opportunity, right? Because when you people are searching for gifts on Etsy, if they come across something that's engineered very well and comes across really nicely and beautifully made, then, you know, they're just more likely to purchase. And the traffic on Etsy is just insane. So, yes, it was always the plan to launch on Etsy. I kind of flirted. I did a Kickstarter about 2 years ago. And I flirted with the idea of, like, putting all the products on Kickstarter first and then move them over to Etsy. But I'm glad I didn't. I just wanted to get on there, like start collecting data basically, and not like analytically, but just understanding which one does well and which one doesn't. Mm-hmm.
So did you go ahead and sort of batch order and then put them up, or did you take more like a made to order kind of approach? So it's like you can place your order, but it will give me like 6 weeks or something.
Oh no! So I just went for it. Okay. I sunk about $7,000 in stock, and I was like, you know, this kind of has to work. But the products themselves, they're kind of calculated risks because. I also do custom bike parts, so custom top caps, custom bar ends, which we can show later or check them out.
I'm going to go get some. I'm going to go get some.
So that was my original Kickstarter, and I was selling on Etsy before launching the Parallel brand. Mm-hmm. Top caps, custom top caps for bikes is a thing. Like people buy them, and there wasn't any decent sellers on Etsy. And the custom Swiss Army knives is a whole sort of subcategory of people that are into EDC, everyday carry, that absolutely love them. And when I stumbled across an Instagram page, Gear et al., I think it was called by James Crichton, I think runs it, I was blown away. I was like, whoa, other people love these things as well. And then suddenly I'm in this world and everyone loves brass, everyone loves titanium. Finally, I've met my people. So, that's why I kind of knew that they would work, but I didn't know the return would be quick, and it has been pretty quick, so that's good.
Is there things you could take from previous jobs that, you know, I'm just, let's just think, sure. there's a listener here that's thinking about starting their own thing, or is there anything that you can take from your time at somewhere like a Dyson to a mouse to, I mean, is CRL a bit like a Dragon's Den 2.0, or is it a little bit Dragon's Denny, or what do you take from those different environments to start your own thing?
Absolutely. So for me, a job is the perfect place to get paid to learn. And in Dyson, I was just like a sponge, just trying to understand how the hell can you make a million things off of the same thing and it works every time? Like, that is a very complicated engineering problem. Going through and understanding how they structure it, I kind of got that big business perspective in Dyson. When I moved to CRL, I was then switched up to, I'm talking to one person and they want to start a business. This is as small as it can possibly get. So I got that, what's important right at the beginning? Well, you need to get your principles straight. You need to understand what is the products that you're going to do, like what's your unique selling point, blah, blah, blah. And then the middle bit is Mouse. So Mouse is, they had a great product and they do have great products and they wanted to grow it and capitalize on it. So I kind of went big business, small business, middle business, and then I started my own thing. So I wouldn't have been able to do Parallel products without that career behind me. I would just have messed up entirely. I think the other thing to mention is I started an Amazon business with my wife a year and a half ago. And that has allowed me to have income. And all that was doing, by the way, just to give you a quick snapshot, that is just going on Alibaba, finding a very good product, rebranding it, designing the packaging, and then selling it on Amazon. And so that's a whole thing.
Is this drop shipping or?
No, it's not drop shipping. Okay. It's buying in bulk, but rebranding an existing product. So it's called OEM, I guess. Original equipment manufacturing. Sorry, I'm on Brixton Road. Can you hear the sirens?
I thought it was here.
Yeah. And without that income, which is not a huge amount, but it was a little bit like kind of trickling in, I wouldn't have been able to invest 6 months of my time designing these products. And I would have just spent absolutely everything that I had saved up. But this time I kind of had a bit of money coming in. So I really wouldn't recommend people starting something with no income and no revenue streams coming from anywhere.
Is that, just, we talk about Amazon selling and that kind of side of thing. I suppose you're from a design and engineering background, is there a slight moral kind of thing where you think, well, is this a crap product? Or are you quite specific on which products you are going to rebrand, etc.? Or do you think it's okay, you bought something from Alibaba, but is this just like, okay, we can make a bit of money out of it, but is this just something that's going to end up in the ocean?
Oh, sure thing. So the product, absolutely, I have a sort of conscience about these things, and I'm not going to put out crap. The products that we went for are all like eco-friendly alternatives. So if you want to know the full transparent, it's called Design Truth, so I'm going to be truthful. The first company that we did is menstrual cups, and we're still selling menstrual cups, my wife and I, in a small way. And the reason that I wanted to go for that is because it actually stops waste, right? So it stops tampon waste. And the product itself is got very good reviews. So there's certain tactics that when you're purchasing an OEM product, if you look and there's an existing seller, maybe an Amazon.com, and you know that's the same as a designer, you know that's the same shape, mold. You know, it's a commodity product. It's going to be the same quality. And obviously, we did user trials. Not that I was ever in the same room, but you know, in hindsight, they would say it was very good and it worked very well. Blah blah blah. So we did trial it. And the other one was a safety razor. So that was made from zinc coated brass, die cast brass safety razor, and it's a very good product. So yeah, it's as a designer, you've definitely got an advantage because you know where a product might fall down in terms of quality. If you get a sample through and it's made of cheap, thin plastic and you can just hear it crackle, you're like, this is brittle, this is going to break, this is going to be a bad product for Amazon. But it was really, for me, it was a lesson in marketing. If you rewind 3-4 years ago, I didn't know how to use Illustrator, I didn't use how to use Photoshop, Lightroom, any of that. And through creating the listings for Amazon, I was able to get better at that. And I was, you know, that's kind of been the journey of how to convey what's good about a product really clearly and concisely, which really helps with everything else.
Mm. So if you was, let's say you're a Design Truth listener and you're thinking, right, I've got this great idea and I'm going to go and start a business.
Yeah.
The things you would say is have a bit of money in your bank account.
Yeah.
Diversify your revenue streams. And so if there's anything, that's something that is a journey I'm on really, in terms of particularly when, I suppose if you'd have left Dyson, for example, they wouldn't have allowed you to go and work for Shark Ninja straight afterwards. And so non-competes and things like that. So, you know, that's a big part of as well of leaving a job, is where it's like, okay, I can leave, but if my product is quite similar to what I was doing before, I might not be able to do that legally for quite a long period of time. And so diversifying those revenue streams, I think, is an important one. And then get good at marketing. I know it sounds a bit broad, but do designers, Drew, obviously you've been in the industry for a while, do you take much consideration to things like marketing, or is that something that you just leave in the hands of the marketeer?
I suppose it depends a lot on the team. Like there's some teams that I've been on where like the marketing representative could be the loudest voice in the room, and that can be good and that can be bad. You know, I always like to have a nice broad set of stakeholders and consider them all, you know, throughout the process. But some companies are driven by, you know, a commoditized product that needs to. It doesn't really matter whether the product is that great. It's more about the language and the messaging. And yet there's others where it hasn't really been thought about until afterwards. And I've seen success and failure in both. And I've felt the sting personally from that as well, where, I don't know, let's say a piece of technology works brilliantly. There's an okay design. And then there's just that final fumble of, well, how do we actually start selling this thing now? And then there's a lot of catch-up to do. And then once you start thinking about that at the end, you're like, oh, shit, we've missed something really obvious, isn't it? Like, it might be ugly or too big or something like that. And it's just, you know. But it has to be right there from the start, from my mind, because, you know, that's going to govern what the market is willing to pay, and therefore what's the, you know, what is the value of it? What does that allow us to do? How do we have to convey that kind of value? Should this be something that is made to be cheap so we can get a whole load of them out? Or is it something where it's going to be super expensive? So it has to communicate that right from the, you know, you see it on Amazon, you go, holy moly, that's a beautifully made thing. That mm-hmm. definitely works well.
It's one of those where you can't just have a great product, or you can't just have a great marketing department, because one, you kind of need them both. Otherwise, one will fall down eventually.
You'll have a lot more success if you could get the marketing story and position right before you've got a product, before you've got a final product.
So would you say the marketing's more important?
No, not at all. No, I think it's a stakeholder that feeds into the design process along with, you know, the human-centered work and design for manufacture. But it drives so much of the cost and the numbers of how many you want to make and, you know, to whom you're selling, that you might sacrifice a user group in order to chase this huge pool of demographic that actually wants to buy the thing. It might be better for somebody else, but they're just not going to buy it.
Couldn't agree more. So when you're setting that initial design brief, you need someone who knows the customer inside and out and can be the voice of the customer and say, this is what is important to our customers and this is what we need to get right. And that needs to be for efficient design. Like I said, at Mouse, we did, you know, 250 SKUs in 2.5 years or something crazy. So we had to go through a lot of design briefs and a lot of cycling through that process. And when we got it wrong is when we didn't agree what's important for the design and the product up front. And when we got it right, it was like, this is the type of product we want. This is what they care about. Let's go and attack it. And the designers, the engineers, they just love solving problems, right? So you just give them a problem. You want it to be this thin. If you get it this thin, you've nailed it. Mm. And then the engineers love that. And they go to town and then they come back and they say, we've cracked it. And, you know, it's a good product.
Yeah. I like it when you know that you've got, even if it's a difference between the user and the buyer, or like whoever's going to buy the thing and whoever's going to use it, and they're not always the same type of demographic at all. And you get that little challenge of, well, how do I speak to that one and, you know, give that one the service? It's like, it's the same sort of challenge, isn't it? Of, it needs to be this stiff and it needs to be this thin. Mm. Like, it's not going in a pocket if it's thicker than this. Yeah, but likewise, if you drop it and, you know, and it breaks, it's of no value. Mm. I see what you mean. I can picture teams that I've been a part of getting excited about, like, oh, I saw this thing. Let's try and make it out of graphene.
Graphene.
What, did you see the other numbers? Like, not just the performance. Did you see it needs to be 60 pence, not, you know, not all of the money?
Yeah, exactly.
I suppose that's why Mouse, you would arguably say, is, are they the number one phone case brand? I mean, I can't think of any others.
I can say with no authority on that.
They're growing.
In the UK,
very, very quickly.
In
one
the
of
UK,
the fastest growing.
Who would you say is the number one in the UK? I could edit this bit out.
I don't know, but
I thought it'd be them. I don't know why.
It's very difficult to understand who's going to be the top, because if you look on Amazon, you know, I don't think they're the top listing. Doesn't mean that they're the top seller, because they're a direct to consumer business. Everyone we're competing with is probably a direct to consumer business. So, yeah, very difficult to tell. But they won an award for, I think, one of the fastest growing businesses in the UK like a year ago. I think.
It must be up there. I'm just thinking of the fact that every time I go on YouTube, all I see is a Mouse advert. Mm. So, you know, every time I'm out in a pub, I see someone with a Mouse phone case. And, you know, that's just, I bought a business work phone and the first thing I did was buy a Mouse.
Yeah,
there
you go.
So
basically, you're in a funnel.
I'm in that funnel. Where am I in the funnel?
Well, you might be at the top, I think, because you purchase, you're probably at the second part of the funnel, which is new products and things like that. It's crazy. Like, e-commerce marketing, it is insanely complicated. All this talk about funnels is basically trying to get people go awareness, consideration, purchase, aftercare, or something. I don't know.
Does this mean I get a discount code soon? Am I in the aftercare?
I wonder if mine still works. I think afterwards, I'll give you
Is this going to get? I'm in that discount phase now. So
yeah, you'll get a nudge soon. You'll get that. You'll get that.
Father's Day email and all that kind of stuff.
So in just talking about the different stakeholders in product design, I wonder if I can do this justice. But one thing that I found interesting in Dyson is that there was kind of three main stakeholders. One was engineering. So if the product didn't work as well as the customer was promised, that person, head of engineering, gets a kicking. One person that's kind of in charge of the customer. It's all changed now, by the way, but this is just when I was there. This is basically one person in charge of this is what the customer wants. And so if the customers don't buy it because the spec is wrong, they wanted a longer lasting battery, they wanted it to do whatever, then they get a kick in. And the last one is the industrial design and aesthetic design. So if it doesn't look like the customer wants it to look, they get a kick in. So that's three people, but beneath those three people was huge hundreds and hundreds of people. I think that's quite an interesting way of looking at it. Like you divvy it up into these three categories.
Mm. Yeah, I think, So I won't name them because there's been a few, but like within the medical devices, you've always got sort of quality, regs, manufacturing, clinical side of things, and then somewhere in the middle you might get design. A lot of it is in-house. A lot of it is, but there's a lot of dogs to feed before you can start really sort of shouting about, well, hey, there's a user requirement that they might have to use this discrete product in a public environment. Mm-hmm. We need to make considerations for that. The challenge that you get there is often that, well, it's not a direct purchase. You know, it'll be something that comes through through a prescription. So they might not even get that choice. It's about whatever their district or whatever their hospital stocks. So really trying to sell that notion that, you know, customers do have choice. I will say customers, users, patients, whatever, do have choices. It's really, really tricky. But it is something that I think, you know, the more you have to sort of tackle that you can get these beautiful products. And then that becomes known that, or like, I suppose that's sort of the brand boost, that becomes the marketing drive, that's what gets you into more of those hospitals. But yeah, the point I'm getting to is that within a lot of those businesses that I've been in, you don't get that industrial design stakeholder at that.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'll make an observation. I'm going to try and make this observation without getting sued. So let's give it a good go. But it's interesting when you mentioned like Dyson, there's like three head of engineering and et cetera. Mm. And then it, obviously there's a huge kind of hierarchy below that.
Yeah.
I thought what an interesting thing about Dyson I've realized over the years is that I would personally say that I think Dyson should be what I would call a center of excellence in terms of from an industry standpoint. That is what it should do. It should be, it's probably still the biggest employer, I would say. And I feel like it's almost got a duty to produce not just kind of great Dyson employees, but great designers for the industry. As a recruiter and someone in on that side of the fence, I can't speak from a technical lens, but what I can certainly say is that I think that the bigger that's got, the I don't want to say the worst, but I think that quality of in terms of being kind of the industry standard. Whereas if you look at a Dyson employee from 10 years ago, that is like the pinnacle, or 10, 15 years ago now, that is like anyone that was in the early days at Dyson, they were shit hot, really, really good kind of. But I think the bigger it's got, the caliber of someone that comes out of the Dyson program now has become a lot worse.
Oh,
just
really?
Just from kind of client feedback that I've had, I can't believe Drew's face, but I'm just saying from a design lens, I can vouch for this. I have many a client that says to me, I don't want to see anyone from Dyson.
No way. Wow. It was a good job. I quit, right?
about 10 or 15 years ago, right?
That's absolutely, because, and the reason why that's the case is, and I'm not knocking anyone at Dicer, but this is absolutely true, and anyone will vouch for this, with of those that were perhaps made redundant earlier in the year and they're finding it a bit of a struggle to find work. It's because that process that you mentioned is almost exclusive to that company. And so when you go out of that bubble into maybe a small design agency, for example, they look at the cost. So this person was earning, let's say, 40 grand a year. And they think, well, they've been there for 3 years. They've got no product to market. They've got nothing they can show in a portfolio. They've worked in kind of, I'm not saying that they're bad designers or engineers, but I feel like they're more suited to a certain type of environment. From my own personal experience. And I'm interested to, and I think that's partially down to the way it's grown so hugely, is it's almost become like this production line of, you know, engineers, which is great from an employment standpoint. But I kind of, the more and more you look at, and when you start looking at the portfolio and you start digging into a little bit deeper, they're really not getting that much exposure of getting a product to market. And I think that is a fundamental flaw in, whilst it may be great for internally for Dicer, but when they're actually starting to look for employment, it's a bit, I don't think that logo on your CV is looked at. Maybe 5-10 years ago it'd been, this person's worked for Dicer. Now they think they'd look at it and go, yeah, but we've seen about 50 of these and they all look, it all looks the same. That might be hot.
It's probably a sort of effect of trying to grow. It's the same thing with a product, right? If you try and scale it very, very quickly, just like they did with hiring, your factory of producing incredible engineers may suffer. The difficulty with anything, particularly in engineering, is that if you have a long cycle time between finding out whether you have a theory, then you put it into practice, then you test the result. If that takes 3 years of someone to develop themselves, it's very, very difficult to keep tabs on whether they're or not they're like actually getting better or the same performance. The other thing that I think is, if because of those redundancies, which was, I thought, absolutely brutal, the market is now flooded with, you know, Dicer CVs. When I left Dicer to get a job at CRL, I had to go to a makerspace and make a table from a CNC machine just to show that I actually knew fundamentals of design. And I also just broke my whatever it's called. I don't deal with them anymore, so I've forgotten what they're called. Non-disclosure. Yeah, I just talked about what the product was. I think it was actually out, to be fair, but because it's very difficult for you to sell yourself without talking about the projects that you've worked on. I think. Yeah,
that's something I've come up against a lot. It's the both things actually. You know, in medical devices, it can take 7 years for a product to hit the market, which is why most of them look really ugly and horrible, because, you know, the molds were cast 5 years ago and they've just been making them and trialing them for ages, and they need to be a certain robustness. So it's difficult to have anything on your CV or portfolio to say, I worked on this and now it's launched. You leave and just say, I was there for a while doing the stuff. And it's difficult to really have anything concrete for it. And that's always been a big source of my frustration. I think I've talked many times about wanting to fill my trophy cabinet. You know, that's how I look at my portfolios. Like when I quit or when I'm sitting on the beach in Abasach, I want to look back and go, I've got some beautiful products in there. And unfortunately, just waiting around on in-house development schedules, there's no guarantee that you're gonna stock it all the way you want. And then in terms of that's it. Like whatever you do have is usually covered by an NDA. So it's very difficult if you're. I mean, I can really sympathise with the large number of those that were made redundant. There's probably not a lot that you can talk about. And it's great work, and I think we do need to have more conversations about, look, here's my approach, here's my process, here's the way that I work and how I tackle problems. I can't really show you any of the end result, but I can draw you a diagram of how I work or something like that. Because, like, honestly, when you get to interview, that's the thing that I want to see is
I suppose when you're looking at the kind of the scale of it, and you've got, let's say, hundreds of engineers working on something, you'll see a portfolio and it's got, let's say, the Supersonic on it, for example. And when you actually get to the nuts and bolts of it, someone worked on it, you worked on a very, very small part of something,
And that's where I think can cause a problem when you're looking for work outside of that, because you haven't actually had true exposure of getting a product to market. You've worked on a very, very small part of something. Of course, some teams are very different, and that's a different makeup within Dice. If you ever speak to someone who's worked in MPI, for example, I find those people are often some of the better people that come through the system. But that's just my experience of dealing with companies, particularly, I think, more so agencies than in-house. I think agencies don't necessarily look at Dyson that favourably, whereas in-house teams will perhaps look at, like, LV, for example, in Bristol, scaling massively. Dyson employees are perfect. Now, the issue they'll have is everyone here has worked at Dyson, and so far, are we getting a more diversity of thought, or are we just turning into another Dyson? Shark Ninja went for a similar thing down in London, where it's just like a Dyson office. So I just find that a very interesting observation, that where it's like the company gets bigger, but I wouldn't say it's becoming a more of a, whereas before I would say it would definitely be like a center of excellence in our industry. Mm-hmm. Whereas now I wouldn't say it is controversial.
I can't speak about Dyson at all. I'm not qualified to do so, but what I would say is, you know, in terms of a center of excellence, I think it's different. Yeah, that's one thing. Yeah, you're probably right. Any organization of that size should probably want to be able to demonstrate that this is the best design team. Thus, we're getting the best products that fit our customers in the best way. In terms of if you're one of those designers, it's the only thing I could think of that's helpful, because I feel like just sort of throwing a lot of shade, would be to, okay, find other processes and keep reading and keep studying and keep practicing other things. And actually, to tie it back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, an Etsy outlet or something else like that, it could be a really interesting, creative way of demonstrating, these are my set of skills and here's what I can do with that. And here's the upshot of it. Here's how close I am to the customer.
For sure. There's people selling on Etsy, and I'm not joking. They're just 3D printed PLA parts, probably from a Creality, you know, like £200 printer, which I've got and I absolutely love. And some of them have sold like 500 products. They're just 3D printed products. And the images are terrible. The listing's awful. But what they've done is they've said it's a phone holder for a protein shaker, you know, something as trivial as that. Or a pencil holder for your desk that has your name on it. Like, and it's, it looks awful. It looks terrible. Yeah. And the point is, if you're a talented designer, you could knock up something very, very quickly. You know, speak to a CNC place, get it done. You get the samples through. Just dedicate a bit of time and money to developing these, like, solo projects to fill your portfolio personally. The other thing, Brad, on another episode, you were saying about developing your USP. You know, how do you stand apart? How do you come across like someone different in the design world? The way that I did it was focus on engineering, and I remember actually, this was brutal. I put a portfolio together and I sent it to someone who's like really high-end design consultant with some of these portfolios are just bonkers, so incredible, amazing sketches. And she's like, this is one of the worst portfolios I've ever seen. You need to figure out like what is your game plan here. So I scrapped it, and I wasn't pretending that I was amazing at sketching. I was talking about process and talking about CPK values, and I can take a concept for a product and get you to a point where you're pumping out these things 10,000 units at a time and the quality is still high. You know, that is what I know, and that is what I can bring. So if you've got a design consultancy, I don't have a huge amount of experience with dealing with consultancies. You guys definitely have much more. But I always feel like the DFM stuff, the engineering, the hardcore engineering principles is where they need to improve their offering, because it means price goes down, quality goes up, everyone's happy, right? So that's what I did.
Yeah, that definitely rings some bells for sure. You know, and I think, you know, to come back to the USP, it's nice to be able to say, well, it's interesting to us, this is the type of things that I like. And, you know, when we had the Fuel on, and they were talking about their Instagram page and how they don't just put products that they've worked on, they put things on there that they really admire. Mm. And I'm saying you could do that. That's not helpful in a portfolio. but at least by sort of reflecting on the products that you like, even if it's just for the sake of your portfolio, because it's, you know, if you're not getting the opportunity to fill it, like,
it's just a mechanism they use because they weren't allowed to show the work they were actually working on.
Yeah, but then that's true of virtually all of us, I suspect, that there'll be a load of your best work that you just can't show. And maybe there's a way of going, well, this was the bit that I really liked about it. It was these materials or this process. I know loads about this process, and here's a thing that could jump on a CNC or on an injection mold device right now.
Yeah,
injection mold machine. And here's the breakdown. You know, show where your gates are, show where your where the lines of draw are, all of that kind of thing.
Could I add to a previous question that you asked before, Brad, which is any advice for people starting their own thing? I would just start as small as possible. You know, it's amazing what can happen with a few kind words of encouragement. So the custom bar ends, you know, it's a bonkers idea. I did all this in analytics, right, on Amazon. I was like, I could sell reflective stickers, I could do blah, blah, blah. Bar ends was the worst performing. I was like, oh, I just love them. I just love brass. I just love knurled brass. I just want to make these things, right? So I just did, and I put them on my Instagram, and I said, you can customize these to whatever. Someone I didn't know messaged me and said, can I have a pair? And I was like, that's my first product that I've sold ever. I don't know when this was. It was a few years ago. And that was that's me saying, oh, well, someone else appreciates the work that I'm doing and this weird idea. But I didn't, because I've met so many different startup founders, right, that have an idea and they bet the house. They say, I need £100,000 of investment. The product prototype needs to be incredibly complicated. They take it to Kickstarter, even if it's a success. It runs away from them and they're struggling to fulfill this thing because they've never done it before. Well, for me, that's trying to enter the Olympics before you've even like run a short race, right? You need to get the fundamentals of delivering, fulfilling.
It's a bit like me on Strava at the minute.
Oh yeah,
I'm at the bottom.
Yeah, working your way up.
Yeah.
But that's the way, right? If you want to, even if you wanted to start a marketing business, you need to buy 10, 15 t-shirts and try and sell them on Amazon or Etsy or Instagram or whatever, and just have that feeling of I've got a thing and I need to sell it in the most basic format ever. And then you can grow from there and say what worked and what didn't work. Because honestly, I've been trying to do these businesses. Like the Amazon business I set up with Selena was a hit, but not something in line with my passions for life. But I've been trying to do these things for like 8 years. And only now is something that's kind of like something's actually taking off. I'm getting a bit of traction. It's like a serious amount of perseverance, but I haven't bet the house on anything. And it means that I'm still here, like working away, and things are kind of working for me.
An inspiring tale. And you know what? I've got a couple of boards here covered in post-it notes with the things that I'm supposed to be getting on with in the background.
Can you reveal any of it?
It's all very similar stuff, but there's some bits that I'll be going for some funding on. So some bits are med tech, but other bits are, well, I've got to tell you, bike components, mountain bike components made out of beautiful natural materials that you can customize yourself. Honestly, when you describe all that, it's like he's already doing it. It's like someone went, I'm doing really well at the thing you're frightened to try. So you
inspire just give it a go, man.
But maybe what about the Pete Kendrick collection?
There you go. Yeah, we can collab. Sure.
Exactly. The Kendrick collection. We do like to ask, we've tried this question a few times, Stu. Some have ducked it, some haven't. But we like to ask a question to our guests at the end, which is, and because you've done a lot of startup stuff, I'm hoping that you might be able to answer this. But the question is, what is the strangest brief that you've ever come across? And I don't know if there are any particular, have you got a good one for any particular startups where you've gone, look, I'm so sorry, mate, but pack this up, get back to your day job.
So in CRL, we had this pitching thing where I pretended I was like a Dragon's Den guy and saying, no, this will never work. Like, I don't know any, you know, I'm just kind of giving my best opinion on whether or not things are going to work. This guy comes in, really sweet guy, probably like 50 years old. And he said, I hate toilet brushes. And I was like, look, I'm with you, man. I think I don't like them either. I can't believe, and he said this, I can't believe it's 2019 or 2018. We're still using toilet brushes. And I was like, I'm with you. Like, let's think about this. Like, hydrophobic spray, maybe on the basin. I don't know. Like, maybe silicone, soft touch silicone. You don't need to touch it. No, he's like, no, I know exactly how we're going to do this. It's a robot. And he showed this, animation. And I won't give away what the company was going to be called, but it was a robotic arm that was sat behind the toilet. And he played the animation, and it was the most hilarious, like, stop motion animation of this arm coming round that was holding a toilet brush and we just did the brushing itself and then came back. And I was like, listen, man, I'm with you, but I think this is not the best solution for this. I think we can come up with something a little bit more elegant. And he was like, no, it's the robotic arm. I was like, no one's going to pay. How much is this thing going to be? He's like, 400 quid. I was like, no one's going to pay 400 quid for this bonkers thing. So yeah, that's definitely takes it.
It's got to be out there, I think, Drew, to be fair.
That's one of the yeah. We've only had a small number of answers for this thing, so
robotic, you've done well there.
Robotic toilet cleaning.
Do we know what this particular chap did with that product, or?
Oh, well, it's not out.
It's not out. Oh, okay.
I might check on Amazon, see if I can find a robotic toilet.
If anyone can, maybe the person's listening. So if the chap is listening to this, then
he's not a fan of design.
But maybe he's trying to get. But if he is listening, then get in touch with us. We'd love to. Right. I'd love to put him in the path of maybe we can get this robotic arm going. Or
tell you what, I want someone to invent that I wanted to do but I didn't is magnetic sock balls. So when you put your socks into the washing machine, you put the balls in, they snap together, so you don't lose your socks. I thought that was a genius idea.
Do you come up with genius ideas all the time?
Yeah, all of them, and every single one is smash hit. Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely
want millions of them.
Yeah. I always kind of think I've got this really good idea, and within about 72 hours, I've normally picked about 20 holes in it, and then I go, maybe calling a supermarket Asda La Vista probably isn't like the best one.
That's really good.
And then it was on the other day, it's down here in Kent, there's a pub chain called Shepherd Neem, which is a brewery. And I hate the beers on draft at these Shepherd Neem places. It's Moretti, and I'm sure not many people don't have problems with Moretti, but when it's the only thing you've got kind of in Kent, it's a bit of a drag. And then I had this idea for an app called On Draft, which was basically before you went to a place, it told you what it had on draft. Yeah. So I could avoid going to a place that's just got San Miguel draft. That's the only good idea I think I've got. But unless anyone wants to pick holes in that, they crack on.
When I was in China, I was seriously considering starting a Deliveroo ramen place called Send Nudes. which I thought was a genius. I was like, I can imagine the logo in like neon signs, Send Nudes XXX. It'd be so good.
It would be very cool. I could see that on like Grand Theft Auto game. It's funny you even mentioned that you had was it a food truck or just I mean, the amount of times that me and Jess talk about wanting to open just a very cool bar that only has like a few beers, but then really nice beers. And then, you know, you get, it's all based around like the tricolore frites. So you get three different types of fries in a set of cups, right? And they're just really, really nice. It's a really, really silly idea. And there's loads more to it than that as well, because it's all based around the amount of food-based television that we watch. We're like, I could do that. I could definitely do that.
We definitely can. Just
buying a load of shit off Wayfair and showing it in the corners. It's like,
so Lark Street Food, which is what it was called, we did it on the weekends. We said, George and I, George ended up being my best man at my wedding, we put 300 quid in each. And with that, we bought a gazebo, a hot plate, and our first order, which was like a big thing of shoulder of pork to make pulled pork and the beef and the brioche buns and everything like that. And it was when that stuff was kind of on the rise.
Yeah.
And that's all we did. And then we paid, we had to send them a photo of our thing set up. They said, yeah, sure, you can have a pitch in Bristol down by the harbourside. You just need to send us a setup picture of you trading already. And we were like, ah, problem. We've never actually traded before. Didn't say that. But we just went to the Downs, the fields in Bristol, set up our gazebo and just pretended we were serving people, just serving air with our burgers. And then that got us our first gig. And then the first one we sold out by 1 o'clock that day, kept doing it, did it for about 9 months. It was so fun, so fun.
The greatest lamb wraps in Bristol.
Oh, well, the Moroccan lamb wraps were phenomenal. Yeah, they were very, very good. Yeah, the next thing, if I ever do a food business, I really want to do bullet tacos, I want to call it. So just incredible tacos with frozen margaritas in, just in like a rusty sort of old van, just full of bullet holes.
So thank you for listening to the latest episode of Design Truth. On the 29th of June, it is World Industrial Design Day. So from all of us at Design Truth, otherwise known as just me and Drew, if you need an excuse to crack open a craft beer or a bottle of wine, this is your excuse for the 29th. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Sorry it did include one minor rant, but as always, we appreciate the support and the comments we receive, sharing your own lived experiences and perspective working in the industry. As always, you can just share those by dropping us a message at hello@designtruth.co.uk. But until next time, look after yourselves, and I'll see you all very soon.